from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 296, recorded live Thursday, December 8th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode of the Framework series, Scott talks with Steve Smith from NimblePros about anti-patterns.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we're continuing the Framework series. Today we're going to be talking to Steve Smith from NimblePros. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, Scott. It's going real well. How are you?
Very, very well. And I wanted to thank you for the lovely gift you sent me in the mail, the Software Craftsmanship 2012 Anti-Patterns Calendar. You've been so kind to send me this calendar. I think now, has it been 3 years running?
This the second year, actually. We did the first one in 2011.
Uh-huh. And this year it's anti-patterns. And what was last year's theme?
Last year was the opposite. It was sort of a best practices, you know, principles that you should follow. This year we just kind of turned that on its head.
Exactly. And this is why I wanted to have you on the show, because patterns are fun, but anti-patterns are lots of fun. So I thought we would talk about some of these anti-patterns and ones that people might not be familiar with, and what they mean to the, you know, the .NET programmer and the programmers in general, and any thoughts we have about when you're creating any kind of a framework. Because I know I've worked on SDKs for the companies that I've worked for, and I've worked on software frameworks that are consumed by other people. And what are some best practices, and of course some anti-best practices that people need to deal with. Looking at the calendar here, the iceberg class. And there's a giant picture of an iceberg. What is the iceberg class?
So the iceberg class is an idea that Michael Feathers blogged about a few years ago. And I don't think very many people have heard of it, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to include it in the calendar for this coming year. Basically, he's got a blog post where he talks about it, and he notes that, you know, a lot of people think that encapsulation in object-oriented programming means that you should hide as much functionality as possible in your class. And that means maybe you should have just one or two public methods and 15 or 20 private methods. Mm-hmm. But he's questioning, you know, whether or not that's good. And the idea is that your class then is like an iceberg with only the tip of the functionality visible.
You know, that's a really good point. I know that there have been times in .NET and the base class libraries and parts of .NET that I wished were not hidden. You know, I mean, how many times have we opened up Reflector and said, oh, that's perfect, oh, it's not virtual, or oh, that's perfect, but it's marked private? Is that an example of an iceberg class?
Yeah, exactly. And in the .NET framework, there are just tons of those that people, I think, love to complain about. And in practice, you can still achieve encapsulation by having another class that does the work, and then just, you know, including or referencing that class. But in this other class that's actually doing the work, it will now have a public interface. And, you know, ideally it's set up in such a way that if you're consuming a framework, you could swap out that class with one of your own, or you could choose to use that class if you needed that functionality yourself.
Why do people hide their code like this? Were we taught to, or was there some way about the way we were taught software in the 90s that made people intuitively want to hide things? I mean, I remember being told, you know, don't make things public if you don't want to support them.
Right. And I remember learning in basically an encapsulation class in my comp sci degree that hiding stuff that, you know, the user didn't need to know about was always a good thing. And I think for frameworks, there's a notion of a surface area that they want to support that comes into play from both a security standpoint, perhaps, and also just from a, you know, limit the number of things that might change that would break other people's code. Because if I use Reflector to get to some private method in the .NET framework and it breaks and I complain to Microsoft, they're going to say shame on me. They're not going to say that they support the private functionality, right?
Exactly. So there's plausible deniability with an iceberg. Someone hits your iceberg, you're like, hey, man, you know, I only saw the top part.
That's right. The Titanic wasn't the iceberg's fault, right?
That's a good point. That's a good point. It was the designer of the iceberg, apparently. February, design by committee. Design by committee. I know that I've spent a lot of time with a lot of smart people in a room and come up with frameworks and ideas, and I've had as many smart people as I could put into a room, thinking that if you have a bunch of smart people and you add them all up, they may equal a smarter person. But inevitably, that's not the case.
Yeah, the biggest problem, I think, with design by committee is you end up with a compromise solution that tries to please everyone and ends up with oftentimes something that doesn't please anyone. And you can have, you know, you certainly can get value by running things through a committee and having meetings and stuff to generate ideas and things. But at the end of the day, it's best if you've got some strong leadership or a strong vision that says, you know, here is what this product does. Here's the persona that we're trying to serve the needs of, and make sure that your API or your product fits those needs very, very closely. I often think when I see this particular this month's picture, I think of that video that went around a few years ago on YouTube of what if Microsoft designed the iPod box. Have you seen that video?
Yeah. It's this great video. It was a real internal video. It was done for education, and it took apart the original iPod box and said, well, here are the Microsoft things that we value, and you know how Microsoft hardware boxes and software boxes have badges and awards and extra information and flip out pages. And by the end of it, they developed a box that, you know, looked exactly like the kind of box you'd see on the older, kind of the 90s versions of the Microsoft keyboard or the Microsoft mouse. I mean, they really captured the essence of it, but it was absolutely an example of design by committee. A bunch of people said, oh, we need this. And what about that? And what about this checkbox? And by the time it was over, it looked like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Exactly. And that happens with your products and your API too, if you're not careful. And you know, I think a lot of really successful companies do a good job of keeping a really tight focus on what the problem is they're trying to solve, and they don't let themselves get distracted with, well, what if we had this, and wouldn't it be cool if we had that?
Such a difficult balance, though. Such a difficult balance. I mean, if the committee is a couple people, sure, but I know that after 5 or 10 folks, it ends up being a mess. But at the same time, to design in an ivory tower and assume that you know what people need, is also an anti-pattern.
Oh, certainly. I think one of the things that you definitely need is early feedback from real users. And I think, you know, a lot of startups and things these days are releasing way earlier than they ever would have, you know, 10 years ago. And I think that helps a lot.
Oh, it's almost a design by crowdsourcing or design by iteration, what's being done now.
Yeah.
So reinventing the wheel. Reinventing the wheel. This is the not invented here anti-pattern, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The a lot of organizations don't trust anything that that they didn't build themselves, or they always believe they can build it better. And so, you know, just reinventing the wheel is a super common anti-pattern. You know, everybody wants to write their own logging framework or their own, you know, way to do authentication. Used to be a huge one, although a lot of people now are using OpenID or Open Authentication or the ASP.NET membership system. But I mean, it used to be every project you worked on, the first thing you did was, okay, well, we need a login page. Let's build a membership system. And all right, great. Now let's build a, you know, logging framework for it.
But I'm wondering, though, that aren't there more complicated things in play? I've been talking to a company recently about some of the different things that they need. And they, you know, they describe what they want, and it's almost exactly like your picture here. You've got like they're crossing out Roller, Axial Rotator Ultimate Edition, Spinner for Movement Professionals. These are all just funny, you know, different synonyms for the wheel. The company that I've been talking to will say, well, you know, we need this, you know, this messaging system by which we could, you know, publish and subscribe. And it's like, oh, you need a service bus. Yeah, I guess so. Are there any of those? And then I'll bring out a service bus or an open source service bus, maybe like N Service Bus, and I'll say, you should use that. And they'll say, well, it's not made by Microsoft and it's not made by us, so we don't really want to do that. And there's a fear of open source, but there's also, this is a new one for me, a fear of using a product that they'll have to justify if and when someone buys them.
I have heard that exact same thing.
Yeah.
And I've heard concern with certain clients, about, well, if we get bought, we'll have to be able to show that we have a good license for this. And I don't know about the license for this open source product or, you know, whatever. Yeah, there's the IP issues related to that. And it just seems to me like that's another anti-pattern of Gagne. You know, you're not going to need it where you're worrying about the possible future of an acquisition. And you know what? If somebody's going to acquire you, they're going to acquire you not because of your service bus implementation. And it's not going to break the deal if, you know, you happen to use a particular service bus versus another one. Like, oh my God, you use Log4Net. The deal's off. We can't buy you for $10 million.
Yeah, but I've also heard concern about people hosting open source. So the fear goes all the way downhill. So you sell a product rather than running it as a service, and then they're saying, well, I've never used open source before. We're going to be installing it in our data center. What does it mean that we've brought this little outbreak monkey into our data center now that this DLL from an unknown source is here? And I've had this issue at banks. I mean, having to do very detailed security analysis, which is an important part of any software system, particularly when it's being used in financial transactions. There's the sense that, you know, things like NuGet or GEMS make it really, really easy to just reach out into the world and pull up functionality of unknown origin, you know, wheels from people who've invented it before, but we don't know those people, and then integrate them into our systems without even telling a boss. There was concern about engineers implementing new features and using open source software without mentioning it to the bosses and giving them an opportunity to even know that it was there.
Well, I think that's a valid concern in some organizations. I mean, if you're in the banking industry or you're dealing with, you know, life and death and things like that, if you're not, you know, selling widgets at a small store or building an internal app, I mean, there's different levels of risk, right? What you were just saying reminds me, have you read Racinovich's book, Zero Day?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with it?
It's on my Kindle.
Yeah. So one of the premises of that is that, you know, people release viruses just into the wild, but the viruses on a particular system are programmed to do something. And I could totally imagine somebody, you know, releasing something into NuGet.org as an open source project mm-hmm. that got popular. But it was, you know, insidiously said, well, if I happen to be running at this particular bank, you know, do something nefarious. And if somebody doesn't, you know, go through that DLL and look for that exact code, it's going to be really hard to find. So I could see if you were a bank that you'd want to have a higher bar for vetting that kind of thing. But I think by and large, you know, I don't know that that's ever been done. You know, maybe I'm giving somebody an idea now, and if so, maybe I'm giving the good guys ideas to fix things, but I think that would be a valid concern in high security environments.
Yeah.
But in most, well, you know, typical, I don't know that it's worth worrying too much about.
I think that everyone's had that idea that it could be done. I mean, PowerShell, it's, you know, and everyone goes and opens up PowerShell and then immediately allows it to run scripts. So, you know, is PowerShell right. A virus delivery system? Well, no more than a batch file, right? I mean, I could certainly send you a batch file and tell you to run it, and there'd be various things that you could, in fact, turn off, right? I mean, safeties are there for a reason. But that's why, hopefully, if someone put something evil into a repository like NuGet or GEMS, the community would find that and spit it out. But yeah, I'm sure that one day it will happen, and then everything will change. But certainly not invented here is still an anti-pattern. We should be open to using software that we didn't write, especially when that software is not our expertise.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's another key point is if you have a business in which you have a competitive advantage, you know, something you do that's unique to your business, that is one of the things you definitely don't want to outsource. But if you have things that totally aren't, you know, your value add, then there's no reason why you should spend your time and your energy on that if there's someone else out there that's all they do and they do it better than you do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Your next month here has a death march, and this is a bunch of people basically like lemmings walking off a cliff. Are these your employees? Do I recognize some of these people here, or are these clip art people?
Those are real people. Those are NimblePros people. There's Brendan, Caitlin, Scott, and Craig.
I thought I recognized the shirt.
A real photo shoot that they did.
So these photos, you made a lot of these, or most of them?
Well, not me personally, but the NimblePros team, mostly our designers, Caitlin and Craig, that you see there, they did the graphics for the calendar, yeah. There's, I think, one or two are stock photos, like the iceberg is a stock photo that we licensed. Mm-hmm. But most of the other ones are are ones that they actually did all the photography for.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I said to myself, "Oh, what a clever idea! I wonder if he just did this whole thing with Google Images." But if you go through it, these are really very high quality, very tailored, thoughtful images. It looks like a motivational calendar that you'd see. It's got the same style, but the photography is really high quality. So in this Death March. We've all been on a death march. Actually, I did a show with Rob Connery about the death march on this developer's life. We've all been on those.
Yeah, and it's certainly an anti-pattern because, I mean, a lot of times there's not a whole lot the team can do about it, but, you know, management just needs to recognize that, you know, if this project's going to fail, you know, just working harder isn't going to turn it around, or adding more hours isn't going to turn it around.
There's always that joke that, If you want to make sure that a project will fail and become a death march, just add more people. And I remember them. What's the old saying that management seems to think that nine women can have a baby in a month?
Right, and right.
Whenever you start feeling like that, you know that you're in trouble and you're on a death march.
Right.
Now this one photograph on the next month called Copy Folder Versioning is really a beautiful photograph. Of some kind of vanilla folders, file folders, all in a drawer, where the person has got my project version 5 on this day and my project version 1.2. But we've all done that before, you know. Just zip it up and rename the folder, and that's source control. And inevitably, people will do that well into the development of their company before they eventually switch over to an actual software versioning system.
Yeah, I've seen clients that this is still how they manage projects. And, you know, it's just scary because it doesn't scale at all. And even for one person, it's often really hard to figure out where the latest version is, or, you know, the branch where you were playing with this particular experiment. You know, the source control software is so readily available and so good these days, especially with a lot of the distributed ones that you can just run everything on your local machine. There's just not too much of an excuse anymore not to use a real source control system.
But why is this so common? I mean, the thing that's so funny about anti-patterns is that we've all seen them before, and that's awful because they're anti-patterns. But, you know, copy folder versioning, we're seeing at companies where, you know, when you're sitting down with engineers and teaching them source control for the first time, why is that? Were they never taught source control, or that they never had a mentor? Or are people not using source control in college?
Well, I think they are using it in college today. And I think this might just be a matter of how long they've been in the industry versus, you know, when they first got in. Because, I mean, 20 years ago, source control certainly wasn't ubiquitous. And, you know, 10 years ago, there were not as many, you know, good options as there are today. So I think, I hope anyway, that anybody coming out of college today knows what source control is and has used it. And hopefully they recognize the value of it. But I think there's certainly folks that have been around for a long time, or maybe they came up through another path and never went to an actual, you know, comp sci degree, but, you know, maybe they got a different degree, or they came up, you know, through business or whatever. And, you know, a lot of developers don't come through academics. And, you know, if you came from writing Excel macros or SharePoint scripts or something, the idea of storing that in some kind of source code repository may never have entered into your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And it's important that we treat folks like that with kindness. You don't want to make a new person or an old new person, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, feel bad because they just may never have been, been made familiar about these particular techniques. So while an anti-pattern might be funny, and something we can kind of point at and say, wow, that is awful. I'm sure no one does that. Instead, we should have a more kind of open attitude of like, yeah, these are anti-patterns. And when you see them, let's educate people and let them know that this is not okay, but show them the light in a kind way that doesn't turn them off for the entire industry.
Right, exactly. And like you said, these are things that we've all done, even professional developers. I mean, it's still something that when I'm going to deploy something to production, mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, I have a little bit of uncertainty about whether or not everything's going to work just right, I'll take a copy of the bin folder or a copy of the website and, you know, just control C, control V, and now I know I can roll back easily if I screw something up, you know. I think that should be a feature of the operating system.
Yeah, in fact, it is. Yeah. But I think you bring up a really good point that they are anti-patterns that we have all done. You know, everyone, Michael Feathers or Uncle Bob or Bill Gates or whoever. Steve Jobs took a copy of a folder once instead of using source control, although I don't think he wrote that much code. But the point is, no one gets to look at a list like this and say, yes, I'm above all of those. I've never done those things. Even the best of us has done every single one of these, which brings us to your next month, which is a wonderful one, the duct tape coder. I'm not sure. Is duct tape, D-U-C-T, is that something that is a universal thing? Is there duct tape everywhere in the world?
I don't know. That's a good question. It's a good question for your readers to tell us about if they're not sure what it is. I know it's pretty universal in North America, at least, although, oddly enough, I understand it's not very good at actually taping up ducts, I've been told.
Really?
So it's even though that's what it's called. If you work in the HVAC industry, I've heard, and maybe this is a myth, that duct tape is actually really poor at holding together ducts. So,
wow, that's funny. I did not even realize that. I think I'm looking here at the ICANN has cheeseburger site, and I believe they have a website that's called There I Fixed It. There it is. It's I just go and search for There I Fixed It, and it's at thereifixedit.failblog.com, and it's effectively actual pictures of people using duct tape to fix things, like they used it to fix mud flaps on the moon lander or a banister on stairs, and just some unbelievable hacks. It's kind of like the daily WTF for real people. So you can find instances of this in the real world, certainly, where people are taping doors onto cars. But what are some examples of doing this in software where you've just taped something together that should never have been done that way?
Well, a lot of times in software, we are given a feature or a bug that we need to implement or fix, and we immediately see, like, I can fix this in this spot, and I could be done, right? But you just feel dirty about it because you know that, you know, you're hurting the design of the code in some way. You know, maybe you just added a simple if check to something that, you know, maybe that you needed to also add that if check in three other places, but nobody's reported those bugs yet, so you don't bother. Or you hard code something that you know should really be in the config file, or you copy something and paste it somewhere else, which we'll talk about as another anti-pattern, and that fixes it, but now you've got duplication. But you're in a hurry, so you don't fix it right then. So a lot of the time it's, you know, doing stuff that's expedient and results in working software, mm-hmm. and the client doesn't necessarily see it, right? This is like, you know, if you don't pull up the hood of the engine, you don't see that it's all held together with duct tape and baling wire because the car's still running. And depending on what it is you're building, you know, that can be just fine. If, you know, if you're in a situation where you're trying to get a prototype out the door for a conference, or you're a startup and you've got, you know, just so much funding to go and you've got to have something out there within a certain time frame, then you probably don't need to worry too much about the technical debt that you're creating. But if you're building software to last and that you're going to maintain for a long time, it's better typically to build it the right way as you go so that it doesn't become a big ball of mud and fall over under its own weight.
Exactly. And of course, the dangerous thing about duct tape coding is that it looks like it works, so you're not going to look under the hood or you're not going to poke around. And when it does eventually break, it inevitably breaks in a spectacular way.
Yeah, or a very hard-to-find way, which is the same thing in our industry.
Yeah, even worse. Feature creep. This is a really great one. You've got a tricycle, and it's got a GPS on it, and it's got a trailer hitch and an umbrella. This looks exactly like software that I have created before. I love the GPS that's very nicely bolted onto the tricycle here, the children's tiny bicycle.
Yeah, and it's got a trailer hitch and a water bottle and a dog. Yeah, they added as many things as they could to this this trike. And then the tagline is, you know, just one more feature and then it's done.
Yeah.
And adding features and feature creep is often something that causes delays in shipping. And delays in shipping are a key form of waste in software development. You know, if you read some of the lean software development books by Mary Popendick and others in that space, you know, the thing you want to do is ship the software as quickly as you can. And feature creep just keeps you from doing that. So
when is feature creep preventing you from shipping an iteration? And how do you, I mean, if you want to be agile and you want to react to customer needs, you're going to be adding features here and there. So if you look at particularly like software as a service and websites as a service, they're always adding something each month. How is that different from feature creep?
Well, see, if they're adding something each month, they're still shipping at a regular cadence. It's when the feature creep results in either shipping schedule overruns or cost overruns that it becomes a problem and an anti-pattern. You know, if you've committed that you're going to ship every month, and then someone says, "Oh no, but it has to have this feature that's a favorite of mine," and there's no way that can happen without either pushing back your release date or doubling the size of your dev team, well, then that's an example of a feature creep being a problem, right? The better solution probably is to cut some feature, ship the thing, and then let the next feature go into the next month's release, right?
Oh, I see. All right, that makes sense. Yeah, simply adding a feature is not feature creep, but letting the direction of the company and the cadence at which you're shipping be affected by features being added at the last minute is the adding pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
And you talk about waterfall. We talk about copy paste programming. There's a great one on spaghetti code. The one that I like the best, though, that kind of smacked me in the face towards the end is the calendar coder, blindly following tips from calendars as a best practice. That was brilliant.
Yeah, that one is sort of a take on the cargo cult programmer, which is cargo cult programming. The idea there being that, you know, you're just following the example that you heard because, you know, someone on Twitter said it or somebody's blog that you respect said it. And just, you know, the general idea there, the reason why that's an anti-pattern is you just really want to understand the concept before you blindly implement it.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. I put in disclaimers on my blog every once in a while when I do things where I know that someone is going to copy-paste it and take it as gospel. And I'll put in these silly disclaimers to make it really, really clear. You know, you got this on the internet. Like, you didn't come here because I know anything. You came here because Google sent you here. And that does not mean that this is the right solution or the right place. So this solution might kill your entire software development team. And don't come crying to me when it actually does happen.
Right. Yeah, I've seen your disclaimers. They're often a lot of fun to read.
You know, and actually, I wrote a blog post on cargo cult programming, gosh, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago. And as I remember, the idea of this term cargo cult was that during World War II, there would be these airstrips on all the islands in the Pacific Ocean. And then when the war was over and all the Americans went home, that the natives that were on the islands where these airstrips were would basically dress up as ground traffic controllers, get sticks, and wave those sticks. And which seems like a totally reasonable thing to do. They're standing on they saw the Americans and the sitting on with these sticks waving, and then airplanes would come in and drop cargo. I mean, you know, supplies would appear. So they were misunderstanding the cause and effect. And I think that applies to, blogs and copy pasting software from around or following tips from a calendar. The idea that, well, if I just start copying software from Steve Smith, he's a smart guy. That's going to make my software really, really awesome software.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's a great Wikipedia thing on cargo cult that talks exactly about what you're mentioning. And that's the thing with software development or in any industry, I'm sure, is blindly implementing things that you think are good practices or that somebody else is telling you, hey, these are best practices, you should be doing them, you know, without doing the research to really understand why they work is an anti-pattern. You know, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yes, definitely. Like, I know I remember learning all of the Uncle Bob solid principles, implementing those solid principles and making sure that my application is in kind of quote-unquote compliance with them without really understanding why I would do that. Is an extremely dangerous thing to do. Blindly doing anything is always a problem.
Yes.
So folks can get the calendar, the 2012 software craftsmanship motivational calendar. They can get it at NimblePros, NimbleProse.com/calendar. That'll take you to the right site. But Steve's got a really cool deal for us here. If you guys tweet, first five people who tweet at Nimble Pros with the hashtag Hansel Minutes will get a free software craftsmanship motivational calendar. So this is, we're now 30 minutes and 12 seconds into the podcast, Steve. For the five people who make it this far into the weekly show, they will be very happy because they're going to get a free motivational calendar. And I appreciate that from you.
Oh, no problem. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this today. And hopefully we'll be able to get through the rest of the calendar in the time that we have.
Well, I'm afraid the time is over. We've got 30 minutes and that was all the time we've got. So I jumped to Calendar Coder, my friend.
Yeah, you jumped to the end. All right, well, that's fine. We'll let the
12 months and 30 minutes.
We'll let the folks pick up the last few months that we didn't cover when they get the calendar themselves.
Exactly. So they can get that at nimblepros.com/calendar, or they can tweet at nimblepros with the hashtag Hansel Minutes, and the first five people that Steve sees will get a copy of the calendar. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.